What were the issues in the early church? What were the major controversies? What was the biblical data that was, you know, looked deeply into to answer some of those issues and controversies? What are some of those issues that persist to this very day, and how were the problems solved back in the early years of the church? We're going to be looking at the early controversies and councils in the first centuries of the church today on this episode of Theology on Air. Thanks for finding us. Thanks for subscribing, because I know everybody listening to this has subscribed on YouTube and to the podcast. Please do more of that and get friends and family to do more of that as well. But this is Theology on Air. It's an outgrowth of Theology by the Pint, which is a monthly gathering, a ministry where we gather around craft beer to talk about theological and ethical and philosophical and scriptural issues that have great bearing on, you know, the meaning of life and how we understand things. I'm Evan McClanahan. I'm almost always joined by Sarah Stone, the Grand Poobah, Executive Director of Theology by the Pint. But it's spring break, and she allowed herself to visit family. She didn't ask my permission, but here she is off wandering into the hinterlands to visit with family. So, Sarah, we miss you. We'll see you back here next week, of course. But do go to theologybythepint.org to learn more about our organization, how you can give, sustain the ministry. We're a standalone organization now. We need people to donate and give to support us, and we'd love your church to participate. So get your young adults group to come out to an event. But I'm Evan McClanahan. I'm the pastor here at First Lutheran. And it's a tale of two Evans today. You know, I got Evan McClanahan, got Evan Frisk, frequent guest, or at least past guest on Theology on Air. Mm-hmm. And you can find him at many Theology by the Pint events.
Yep.
And at Missio Dei, Anglican Church.
Yep.
Okay. He's one of these lay guys that, you're a philosopher. You do have a master's in philosophy and have taught philosophy at the collegiate level.
Yeah, I still teach it.
I still teach.
Okay. Yeah, it's a little bit reduced at this point, but I still teach.
Okay, because you got like a full-time job that, you know, pays the bills.
Right. I decided to have a family.
Insert joke about, you know, philosophy.
Philosophy major. Not making money.
Yeah, okay. Well, I have a music degree, so there you go. Same deal. So, okay, but, you know, so a trained philosopher, widely read, you know, theologian, you know, knowledgeable about the issues, and kind of caught a bug to, you know, to delve into the councils. I said, yeah, that would be interesting. So if this is kind of history, this is kind of theology, but to our listeners, you know, the thing is, we kind of take for granted, you know, what they, you know, settled in the first centuries of the church. And I do think that we'll be able to demonstrate that many of those early heresies continue into this day.
Yep.
Since most of the early councils deal with the person of Christ, or the nature of Christ, I might say, or the two natures of Christ. You get the idea, right? Right away, we're going to get into the Trinitarian conversation. So if you're kind of into this kind of the theology of what was going on, you're in the right place, because we're going to kind of take a bit of a deep dive on that. So let's try to set the stage. Let's see. In the beginning, anyway, we'll jump all the way to the cross. You know, Jesus is crucified. On the third day, he's risen from the dead. And Luke, as he records in Acts, you've got the church sort of scattered, but forming in known parts of the world. Kind of a cliche, but taking advantage of the Roman Empire, right? The roads that were built to transport militaries and establish colonies and whatnot are pretty useful for the spreading of the gospel as well. So the gospel spreads to the known world at that time, kind of out from Jerusalem to Asia Minor, which is like modern-day Turkey, and to, obviously, Europe and northern Africa and all of that. So you have the church spreading. But, you know, pretty soon you also start to have questions like, well, what do we believe about this issue? And you have disagreements. So you have councils, ecumenical councils, which we'll get to, whose purpose is to sort of come to understand what it is Christians ought to believe and how we come to those conclusions. It's not listed as one of the ecumenical councils, but you do see some kind of example of this in the Bible itself in Acts 15. So maybe talk a little bit about the so-called Jerusalem Council.
Yeah, so the Jerusalem Council is Acts 15. They are dealing with the controversy of we used to be Jewish, now we are Christian. What does this mean, and what's the differences between the religions? It probably was not perceived as a difference of religions at that point even. It was just what's the good way to continue to worship God. And in particular, they're bringing in Gentiles. And the question is circumcision still required? Circumcision, of course, is in Genesis with Abraham. It's commanded to him in order for him to have children. And of course, those children then make up the Jewish tribes. So are the Gentiles in being grafted into the church at this point, are they part of the church by their circumcision, or are they part of the church in some other way? Ended up ruling circumcision is not required, and then they ended up listing the only requirements that are given for being part of the church as a Gentile. Sometimes they list it as three, sometimes they list it as four, but it is sexual immorality, eating food polluted to idols, and there's the weird one, food that was strangled, and then I'm forgetting there's one in the middle there that I'm totally blanking on.
Yeah.
But it's three and a half. I remember it's the weird one.
Sexual immorality.
Sexual immorality. Okay, yeah, it's the first one they listed.
Yeah.
And then
it's kind of like the sine qua non of what to avoid, though, right?
What are the
things that as we gather as Christians, Jew, pagan, which had to be really weird,
right?
So there's so much enmity between those groups.
They tried to get as specific as they can, but also the council ruled that like there's not a whole lot of specificity here.
Yeah.
And that was part of the decision of the council that
yeah.
Gentiles were brought in particular without a lot of the Mosaic law.
Yeah.
None, that wasn't a Gentile thing.
Yeah. So yeah, big picture is like yeah, you don't have to become a Jew to follow the Jewish Messiah. And right. they recognize there are aspects of Old Testament law that no longer apply.
Right.
But there are some aspects of Old Testament law that do still apply. And so that would be a modern, something I talk about a lot on this podcast. Trying to find out what the answer to that is, isn't always easy, but I think we should at least try.
There's a fun, I guess there's a theology that I would agree with here, that the things they list in Acts 15, and y'all are going to have to actually look it up because I can't remember the whole list, all has to do with things commanded by God, but before Moses.
Mm.
That in particular, the strangulation of animals is forbidden under Noah in Genesis 9.
Yeah.
So that all of the things that they prescribed were pre-Moses commands from God, which means that there wasn't a Mosaic law yet. And these were commanded to Gentiles as well.
Yeah. Therefore, my judgment is that we should not trouble those of the Gentiles who turn to God, but should write to them to abstain from the things polluted by idols, and from sexual immorality, and from what has been strangled, and from blood.
Okay. There's the third.
I think it's strangled in blood.
Blood.
Because the life is in the blood and all of that.
Yep. So, that's the Genesis 9.
For from ancient generations, Moses has had in every city those who proclaim him. For he is read every Sabbath in the synagogues. So, yeah, interesting stuff there. Okay, so that's just an example, though, where you have Paul kind of going off, and has a special mission, to the Gentiles, and so you've got the issue like in Galatians 2, I post Peter to his face. I mean, you have conflicts in the early church. If you're not sort of that familiar with the Bible, that might come as a surprise to you. You might think everything in the Bible is all hunky-dory all the time. Well, there were issues, and this is how they resolved them. They had to talk it through. Now, immediately, we should say a quick word about, what standard do you solve these, problems? And so, immediately, as I'm thinking about the gospel being spread from Jerusalem to the known parts of the world, you're going, well, what did they appeal to? Well, the Bible, one of the things that really irritates me is when Christians will say things like, well, the Christians didn't have a Bible.
They totally did.
Yes. And what was that?
It was the Torah.
Yeah. Well, the Torah. Well, I say the whole Old Testament, right? We call the Old Testament. But, the Tanakh, the Torah, the Netivim, the Ketuvim, that's the Torah,
mm-hmm.
the first five books of the Bible. Also, that word means law in Hebrew, the writings, and then the prophets. And so, like the writings being wisdom literature, like Lamentations and the Psalms and mm-hmm. Proverbs and things like that. And then, of course, the prophets, the Isaiah and the Jeremiah and the minor prophets and all that. So that was the, and particularly the Greek version of that called the Septuagint, or Septuagint, as some people say. So, the New Testament did have a Bible. It's called the what we call today the Old Testament. And it was particularly the Greek version of that, and I think you can demonstrate that by... In fact, if you watch the debate we hosted on whether or not Jesus is Yahweh at our church between James White and Dale Tuggy last week, Dr. White, I think, does some really interesting work looking at direct phrases in Greek that transfer from the Old Testament into the New Testament in Paul's writings and in Peter's writings, especially, to prove that Jesus is Yahweh. So, that aside. So, I will say, I will grant, I guess, to the skeptic, that as the gospel is spread, these Old Testament, the Septuagint is probably carried along with it, but you have a fragment of what we would consider the New Testament. It's almost certainly not all collated there. You have probably some of Paul's letters, some of the Gospels. As time goes on, those things get copied more and more, so they become codified and put into not scrolls, but codexes. And so they begin to be put in libraries and gathered and things like that. Okay. But generally speaking, eventually you're going to have these disagreements. You're going to have people come together, and they're going to have to decide some pretty significant issues. So let's talk about, I guess, the First Council.
Yeah, so the First Council is 325, Council of Nicaea. It is the first ecumenical council. That's going to be a special term here. That just means it's the entire church of the world at the time. So Christianity is legal in the Roman Empire once again. It actually has gone in and out of legality for 200 years at this point.
I mean, almost all of the churches in the Roman Empire at this point?
Actually, no. So okay. There's a substantial portion in Persia and Arabia that does not count as either Western or Eastern Roman Empire, and then Ethiopia in addition.
Okay.
So it has not made it very far north, though. The northern Germanic tribes did not like the empire at all, and actually they rejected Christianity for a while, and then only when after these councils the German Christians converted to non-council, like the anti position on the councils. Ah. They went with whatever the councils did. They did the opposite of whatever the councils said.
And that was the work of Martin Luther, right?
Martin Luther.
No, that was a joke.
Yeah.
That was a joke.
Converted all the Vikings.
Now I've confused people. Okay. Martin Luther is 1,000 years later, 1,200
right.
years later.
Okay. So this is in 325 AD. So this is about 300 years after Jesus died. The Emperor Constantine convened the council because there was zero set definitions on what we were, how we were worshiping Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That there was no order to any of this. Nobody had systematized this. And so he called as many bishops as he possibly could. So he invited 1,800 bishops to come and convene at Nicaea, which for layman's terms, let's just say is a suburb of Constantinople. So it's just outside the capital in order to hash this out. Because travel was so difficult, there's probably about 300 that showed up.
Hope they had enough Airbnbs for that.
And I bet they were treated well, considering this is a request of the emperor.
Yeah.
And tried to figure out exactly what they meant. And then they used not only scriptural jargon from both Old and New Testament, but also some of the philosophical terms that were being thrown around by popular theologians at their time, and then providing definitions for really what they meant.
Okay, let's even go back a little bit, because you have the Edict of Milan in 311 or 312. But explain what that is. So that's Constantine legalizing Christianity, as
right.
I understand it.
Right. So Constantine did not convert to Christianity until much later in his life. It's his mom that converted first. And under Roman law, his mother should have been arrested. So he changed the law. Oh, he didn't convert until later, though. And then he had definitely converted by calling the council, and then awkwardly was baptized after the council. They had a weird superstition that if you were baptized right before your death, then you didn't go to heaven with any sins on you. So you were as spotless as possible. And of course, we've got different opinions on baptism now throughout the entire church on what baptism does. And I don't know anybody that actually holds to that view anymore.
Yeah.
But that was a very popular thing to do. and generally was actually condemned by those same theologians, but they still were doing it.
But in theory, if you believe in purgatory, then you would go to confession, hopefully right before you die. And of course, they have last rites.
Last rites, extreme
unction for that purpose, maybe to get out of purgatory. But anyway.
No, that's exactly what last unction is for. It's to make you as clean as possible.
Yeah. I mean, it is the seventh sacrament of the Catholic Church, so it's not a small deal. Okay. So, but the Edict of Milan was kind of groundbreaking in that, you know, Christianity didn't become the official religion of the empire yet, mm-hmm. but it did become a tolerated religion within the empire alongside pagan empires. So that bought them a lot of freedom. Until then, there was, you know, persecution throughout the centuries and, you know, pockets of Christianity here and there. They weren't all illegal. They weren't all thrown into the gladiators.
Right.
Gladiator 2 coming out in November, by the way. Anyway, they weren't all, weren't all thrown into the arena, or anything like that. You know, but that did happen in pockets. So Council of Nicaea, 325. By the way, is this when Christianity is made the, because there is a reversal where maybe it's later, I can't remember, but I could Google it real fast. I don't use Google anymore, sorry. But I could look it up on a search engine and find out very quickly that at some point Christianity becomes the legal religion of the Roman Empire and paganism becomes the illegal one, and then they persecute pagans. So
yeah,
kind of much better.
I'm also blanking on the exacts here, but I'm pretty sure that's done under the not the following emperor, but the one after him.
Okay.
That so Theodosius the second.
Yes. Okay. What Constantine? Yeah.
Yeah, Theodosius the second. I'm pretty sure was the one that did that, and he's the one that called the second council.
Okay. So what were the main issues at this time?
So one of the reasons I found this so interesting is because the councils intersect history, philosophy, theology. And politics. Hmm. So there's political reasons that the emperors are doing this, and all of these councils are called by an emperor.
What? It wasn't just the altruism of just knowing what the Bible says?
Oh yeah, nobody sat there with me and my King James Bible in 325. No, gotcha. they had disagreements with a lot of times language. So Latin and Greek were the standards, but there were plenty of other languages as well. There was lots of secular philosophy that had worked its way into the religion that they were purging out as well. For example, I don't know if we'll have time to get all the way to Council 5, but in Council 5, they condemn vast swaths of Origen as being anti-Christian. Origen was actually one of the more popular philosophers at this point in the 300s. So you have to wait 200 years to get him before they do some serious critiques on what are the actual conclusions for this. Gotcha. The early Christians, like even before the councils, were very friendly to Plato and actually pretty anti-Aristotle. And because the Platonists held a lot of the same initial understandings that were very Christian friendly. And then over time, they actually learned that Platonism became a problem in things like the incarnation.
Yeah.
They didn't like the idea that God had a body. They didn't like the idea that Jesus might be co-eternal and co-equal in majesty to the Father. They wanted him to be like an eternal middle ground mediator guy. And so by the time you get to the 300s, you start pushing they're trying to push Plato back out of Christianity. Mm. Even though originally they were very friendly to the idea, it held a lot of the similar values, the idea that our kingdom is not of this world, that
can you give like a 1 minute summary of Plato versus Aristotle on these issues of like, I don't know, forms and the goodness of matter or what?
You've made me so happy. So
okay. But I only gave you 1 minute. So.
Hey guys, Sarah here. Sorry to interrupt what I'm sure is an amazing podcast episode, but I just wanted to tell you that Theology by the Pint is growing. We are now a 501c3 nonprofit organization and we're expanding. This coming year, with your help, we'll grow our reach by adding events in multiple Houston suburbs, as well as launch a youth version. Don't worry, those will be pints of iced coffee, not beer. We're adding follow-up conversations to reach the spiritually curious and the unchurched. We're also growing our connections and partnerships with more local churches, and you can help us grow by praying for us, by telling your friends or church about us, and of course, by partnering with us financially. To donate, go to theologybythepint.org/give. You know, if each of our podcast listeners gave $100, we would reach our annual budget right then. Consider donating today. Okay, enjoy the rest of the show.
So Plato thinks that first there are forms, and in particular forms are not physical, and that but these forms, however, are found in the physical world as shadows and types and things like that. And really what they're doing is by looking at something that has, say, geometry is an easy example, something that looks like a square. We know it's not exactly square, but it makes us recall our knowledge of the forms that we already have in our souls when our souls were part of the forms. Aristotle takes the exact opposite direction, where first we start with a world of experience and then we abstract into these forms, and that those forms are higher knowledge and we had to build up to get there. Mm-hmm.
How would that apply to the incarnation? But go ahead.
So to the incarnation, Platonists really want a spiritual entity to make himself manifest, but they likewise think that physicality is lower and like impure. So
form is the ideal. The
right
filling out of the form, so to speak, is less than ideal, I guess.
Right. Yeah. So it's impure.
Okay.
There's a weird superstition about it. So you get guys like the Apollinarians, for instance, would have been very much into Plato. All of the early Gnostics, Apollinarians included, are end up being Platonists, and the idea of Jesus as divine was very easy for them. But the idea of Jesus as made flesh was not easy at all. But for Aristotle, this isn't an issue at hand. Aristotle thinks that the incarnation actually would have been really, really easy. Like that of course, like God would, if he was to take on a human nature, would have to start from the bottom and then build himself up, and in the human ways. So those are all totally fine. The Aristotelian understanding of form ended up being more friendly to certain necessary, like groundings of the faith.
Gotcha.
So you get a big Aristotle push thereafter, and then actually it's Protestantism that works Plato back in.
So to be clear, that Aristotle was 300 years before Christ, but there are philosophical ideas that are compatible, we would say, with Christian theology.
Right. So like our discussions on bodies and souls is historically Aristotelian.
Yeah.
But now I actually think that Platonism has dominated the culture again.
And just to put a pin in it, later, 1215, the Council of Constance, I think you've got, transubstantiation becomes dogma of the church. And we've talked about this when we had our priest on a while back, but that deals with, Aristotelian philosophy, substance and accidental and
substance and accidents.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. So kind of understanding that and kind of the bread and wine, the bread and wine have the substantial properties of Christ, but the accidental properties of bread and wine. So anyway, just to put a pin in that. Okay. So, but what's going on? I mean, I mean, essentially we have what we would call today like a Trinitarian dispute.
That's
arisen, right? Is Arius already around?
So Arius is Council One. Arius was claiming that Jesus was the first of all creation, meaning that Jesus was created, but also he existed before the in the beginning line of Genesis.
Okay.
So that Jesus then created everything else. So we have the Father, the only thing the Father creates is Jesus. And then Jesus creates everything else in Arianism.
Okay. And we're saying Arian. Arius was a guy.
Oh, yeah.
A-R-I-U-S, not Arian as in the master race, not A-R-Y-A-N. So we're not talking about master race stuff. We are talking about a guy who is like the original, the OG in the worst way, Unitarian, you'd say. So he believed that God – he believed in God. He believed God was one person, so he's Unitarian. He's not Trinitarian.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So basically, Jesus was like – first, Colossians 1. This is a text that – I'll just go ahead and spoil it here. Jehovah's Witnesses will argue at your doorstep that Jesus is the firstborn of all creation. So he's really, really high. He's like super important, but he's not –
But he's not number one.
He's not God. He doesn't share the – what? The form?
The divine nature is the phrase there. But yeah, it ultimately, like, what is the divine essence?
Because like Paul in second, in Philippians 2 talks about the metamorphe. Sorry, I don't have it in front of me. Anyway, no,
morphe is literally the Greek word for form.
Gotcha.
So like it's a biblical term and because it's just part of the Greek language.
So we would argue there's a biblical case to be made for these.
Yeah.
The forms of God being shared. Okay. But anyway, fill that out a little bit. So you have Arius. He's saying, hey, this Jesus guy is great. He's not quite God though.
Right. So he's not quite God. And so the question is, do we worship him? How do we worship him? What is, what's the status of the Trinity at all? He's not the only one that doesn't believe in the Trinity at this point. The Gnostics think that Jesus is a kind of demiurge. You've got, like maybe you have true Unitarians like Tully that thinks that Jesus was created.
Dale Tuggy.
We think that Jesus was created at that specific point in time. You have adoptionists that think that Jesus was adopted later and then infused with the divine at a later point in time. Usually they choose his baptism. So there's a lot of other options that the church could have gone with. But there were weird ways to this would flesh out. So for Arians, the question is on worship. Like, would you worship the Son? And they would say, no, only the Father deserves worship. And they would quote things like the end of Revelation, where the angel says, no, don't worship me. As do the Jehovah's Witness today. The Jehovah's Witness are essentially the Arians. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, Tuggy is not.
Yeah.
He
actually spoke quite poorly of them in his opening remarks.
He did. He did.
Basically saying there are their intellectual anti-intellectual rubes, and they don't know how to do Bible study, but I do. So, or philosophical study. But anyway,
for the adoptionists, it's was there a human that was made God, or did God become man? Like it ends up fleshing itself out in a number of different ways, and ultimately this is going to come to soteriology, was how am I saved? Because we are saved by a reconciliation of us to the Father, and how that is done absolutely matters. It's going to be groundbreaking. And then ultimately, like, what's required, what's not required, what's freely given, like all of those discussions are all wrapped into first, who is God?
Yeah. I mean, texts like, in Peter talks about, for his, I'm sorry, should have pulled these up, but basically our sins are forgiven by the shedding of his blood. Or then for 2 Corinthians 5:21, he became sin, Christ became sin, who knew no sin, so that we might become the righteousness of God. So might call it the blessed exchange, but that only works if Jesus is God. Like, Jesus is only a suitable substitute if he is divine. If he's not, our argument is, the Trinitarian argument is, he's just a good guy who died for a noble cause.
Right. So I think it's Gregory of Nyssus that says whatever is not assumed, that is assumed by God, that God took on something, is not redeemed.
Yeah.
And so the big argument of, is Jesus fully human, which is what Gregory was dealing with at that point, is if he's not fully human, then we're not fully redeemed, because Christ redeems all of humanity. So some of the groups were honest about this and just said, you're right, some of humanity is not redeemed, you better get to work on it.
Mm.
And so it changes salvation and what is required radically, very fast.
Right. And Arianism was not a small thing.
No, Arianism was massive. And then in particular, it grew in those German tribes.
Yeah.
So Arianism took off like nobody's business farther north. Because they were anti-empire.
Maybe that is Aryan.
I don't actually know the etymology there, but I bet you it's connected somehow.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I bet it's connected.
I never thought of it. Sorry, whoever brings up Nazism first loses. But Nazism was in many ways the celebration of the Germanic, mystic pagan gods and whatnot.
Yeah, they had weird superstitions.
Yeah. If you look at the early days, like the parades and the floats and whatnot, it was all like these Norse gods, and this master race idea. But anyway, and the further north in Germany you go, I think the more prevalent that is. Okay, so Arianism, at one point, Arianism I think it's safe to say, outnumbered what we would consider Orthodox Christianity. And there was a lot of political power involved, right?
Right, so, yeah. So so Arius was a presbyter in Egypt, and he was in conflict with his bishop. And there were the majority of the population, like the majority of the Egyptian church at the time, was siding with Arius and against the bishop.
Yeah.
And then when this started coming out that there was a going to be a debacle over homoiousios and homoousios, fancy Greek terms.
Well, let's break those down. That's important.
Okay. So yeah. Arius was really stressing the idea that Jesus was like God. And so in Greek, it's a compound word, homoi and ousios is similar substance. His own bishop, whose name escapes me, says that instead it is homoousios, meaning same substance, that there is that the Son and the Father are the same one being, was the bishop's position, and Arius actually was winning the popularity contest.
Yeah.
That Jesus was not the same being as the Father, but was similar in many ways.
Yeah. So, one letter. We're talking about one Greek letter.
And honestly, like from like a if we were to go preach to farmers that had never heard the gospel before, like that seems like a really easy, honest mistake. Like that's way more intuitive because that is how the world works. But the problem is heaven doesn't necessarily work the same way.
Yeah.
So,
Well, when we're talking about the Trinity, you're talking about something unique. There's not an exact parallel anywhere else on earth. So, and now critics will say, well, wait a minute, you know, that's not a biblical term. And it's true. Homoousios or homoiousios, you will not find either of those in the Bible. This is a kind of what I consider like a best effort, a best attempt to understand this radical, the nature of God and the way in which the Father and Son and Spirit, or maybe I should say God and man, are one in Christ. Maybe that's imprecise language,
though. Yeah, so that's the discussion of councils 3 through 6.
Okay.
But 1 and 2 is the nature of God.
Okay.
Qua God.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. But if you've never heard of that phrase, that's a fancy 10-cent word at seminary that, you know, you're going to learn.
Homoousios.
Homoousios. So it's good that you're familiar with that, because there was a lot of debate going on in these early centuries, and it got pretty nasty. I mean, you know, you had a lot of power plays, I'm sure. The councils were supposed to. Now, Athanasius is later, right? And Augustine's later, right?
Correct. Augustine is after Second Council. Athanasius is during Second Council.
Okay. So
maybe Athanasius is First Council. Actually, he definitely is, because he's the one that got into a fight with Arius.
Okay.
Saint
Nick beats up some Arian.
Yeah. Right? So Athanasius, you're right. It's Saint Nick. Saint Nick ends up punching Arius in the face during the council. And
legend has it.
We have got notes that he was at the very least kicked out of the council for about 3 days and made to come in and apologize for something.
This is the Saint Nicholas, the Santa Claus. Okay.
We have got records for these things, it's awesome history.
Yeah.
We've got records for these councils in more detail than we do other major historical events before or after.
We don't maybe really have time to dwell on this, but one of the questions I have is why, what is so attractive about the Unitarian position or the Christ is not divine position? I mean, on the one hand, they would say, well, we're just interested in the truth, and that's what we think the Bible says. Yeah, okay. But I find there to be some kind of like hostility there as well. Similarly, in a way that, say, you would pray to a saint or you would pray to Mary. I don't know. There's something about like the holiness of Christ and the, you know, what Christ has done for you and the accessibility of Christ that seems to be, I don't know, unpopular. And so I don't know what to do with that. But I wonder, I mean, I guess I could say it's just satanic. You know, it's just people drawing people away from the worship of Christ, which is what the devil wants.
That'd be fair.
Yeah. Maybe it's just that simple. But I'm curious genuinely what is the harm of Jesus being God, you know?
I think that it's not intuitive, because now you have to say that there's three persons that are one being and all at the same time. And then we've gone for at least decades in a bluntly anti-intellectual route for the Trinity. We've told people, the Trinity's complex, don't think about it.
Wait, say that again. You're saying 3 decades?
For at least like in from what I know, United States intellectual Christianity has avoided the topic of the Trinity.
Okay.
Of just saying like, the Trinity is very complicated. Let's not worry about it.
Yeah.
Like, that is absolutely the dominant thought about the Trinity.
Yeah.
And now you have some people that said, no, I would want to think about it. And they've coming to the same weird conclusions that everybody outside the councils did in exactly the same time period.
Yeah.
So we're repeating history over again because we're not reciting the full Athanasian Creed once a year.
And there are other Unitarians other than Jehovah's Witnesses. I mean, again, a few nights ago, we had a debate between Dale Tuggy and James White. And Dale Tuggy is part of the Unitarian Christian Alliance, so they use the word Christian. But they really don't like the Unitarian Universalists who come out of other movements. And that was a merger between Unitarians and Universalists who merged to form Unitarian Universalists are barely religious at all in any significant way. Mm-hmm. So anyway, different things. Okay. So we got homo, uzius, you know, same nature, similar nature. And the whole debate comes down to that one letter. And at this council, who wins?
At the council, homo, uzius wins.
All right.
So Arius loses.
So they take a vote.
Lots of fun conspiracy theories that the vote was super narrow. And Dan Brown, I think, has a whole thing in his book about how narrow the vote was here. It was not narrow at all. It was all except three. Yeah. And it was Arius and two of his buddies.
Yeah.
Like, that was the vote. So all of the bishops from throughout the world that came, all of them voted that the Trinitarian position was the scriptural position, was the authentic teaching of the apostles. They defined specifically in the first council the Father and the Son, and they actually did not go into depth at all about the Spirit because that wasn't what the controversy was about.
Yeah, we'll get to that later.
So they actually, in the current Nicene Creed, there's four sections, and in that first council, they have the first two fleshed out, and then the third one, they just say, we believe in the Holy Spirit, and then everything else is blank.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, so they resolve it. The Arians politely say, oops, sorry about that. We guess we were wrong.
Not at all. Arians are going to be with us for hundreds of years.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, do we want to go to council number two?
Council number two is dealing with similar issues. So the first council is Jesus God? Second council is Jesus man? Mm. And so they get a little bit more into depth about being born of the Virgin Mary. Suffered under Pontius Pilate, like in his physical humanity that he actually lived.
That is like more on the Gnostic side or maybe the Platonic side then, right? Because Gnosticism essentially argued that, and this is very much alive and well today, that physical bad, spirit good, to put it simply.
Right. The idea that God would condescend to the physical world ends up – it was anathema to a lot of the people
there. And that's an argument we have in Islam.
Yep.
And so arguably, not to say that they were Gnostics per se, but later, Muhammad is what you might call a radical Unitarian monotheist.
Right.
And so he rejects, obviously Trinitarian theology. Arguably, he didn't understand it, but okay.
Yeah, actually, so we can absolutely get into that. So there's things I think that are a natural road out of Christianity and into Islam by rejecting the Third Council. So I think it's actually that he was a product of his culture. Like Muhammad was a product of his culture that believed weird things about Jesus because of this ultimately a Gnostic position that the spirit is good and the flesh is bad.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. So Second Council then. So we First Council was all about Jesus was God. Okay, so we all agree he's a man, but we're saying he's also God, and that deals with, as you say, substitutionary atonement issues and things like that. Okay.
Yeah.
Later, though, people are going, wait a minute, I think he was God, but he couldn't have been a man.
Right. So they had to readdress this issue 70 years later.
Okay.
So they called a second council, got a lot of the same bishops. They also called every bishop that was available.
Yeah.
They got a bunch more bishops show up, also flesh this out. And again, they settled very firmly that Jesus is simultaneously man and God.
So there's a kind of joke. I don't know what this comes from. I don't know if it's a writing at the time or like one of the Gnostic, false kind of gospels, you know, one of the Gnostic gospels that were written in like the 3rd, 4th, 5th century.
Yeah.
But there's this thing where like, you know, I was walking with Jesus, but I looked back and there were no footprints. It's kind of like that cheesy footprints in the sand thing, but right. It's not because he was carrying you on the beach, but because he literally doesn't make impressions. So the idea is that, I guess post-resurrection, there are some interesting aspects of Jesus' resurrected body. For example, he can walk through walls. Right.
Right. But he maintains his scars.
Yes.
As well. So there's, Jesus seems to be doing both.
Yeah.
Which is the whole point.
Right. Yes. 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 No, but people can key in on one or the other. For example, he eats fish with the disciples on the side of the, which always makes me hungry. I'm hungry right now thinking about broiled fish on the side of the sea. But, you know, but they're gathering in this locked room in the upper room and he can go into the midst of them. And the author, I think it's John, is careful to say, the doors were locked, you know, so, and there he is in the midst of them. And so the impression is that he, you know, he didn't have the magic key or something. He can walk through all. So the resurrected glorified body that we will also get, by the way, is physical. You can touch the scars. Thomas famously touched the scars, but there is it's like beyond the physical dimensions too.
Right. Right.
So it doesn't age, doesn't sin. Arguably there's an aspect of physicality that is maybe tied to, the fall.
Right. So that's generally the Gnostic position was that the physical was tied to the fall in that way, and ultimately getting rid of the physical is the solution.
Yeah.
And that flies in the face of the incarnation, where God Himself takes on the physical in order to redeem us.
Yeah.
Not from the physical, but redeem like the physical world.
So we would say, So we would say the physical is not bad.
Right.
In fact, it's good.
It's good.
God made it and it was good before fall, right? Before Genesis 1 and 2.
Yeah. So notably, some of those early Gnostics actually would rewrite the creation story or rewrite their own books to try to make the physical world bad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the Valentinians in particular, this early Gnostic sect in Alexandria, that was also a huge hub for Platonic philosophy.
Yeah.
They created a whole different a story where there was multiple archons and aeons and that existed before, and those guys cooperated together, and one of them was evil, and that one made the physical world.
Mm. Sounds like Scientology.
It gets literally weirder than Scientology some of the times. Yeah.
And by the way, they're just as an FYI, like within Gnosticism, you could have kind of two schools. Let's see. There are the ones that ate. And the gluttons, right? And then there are the ones that starve themselves. And both were because of their understanding of the physical world. So like, if the physical world is bad, you could consume it all you want and it was no harm, no foul because it was just...
Because it was just your body.
Just your body. But there are others who are like, but the body is bad, so don't give in to its lusts.
Right. So Augustine in particular was on the former of those.
Ah.
So before Augustine converted, the Manichaeans thought that in particular sex was... totally fine with anyone you wanted to. And it didn't really count as adultery unless you lusted with your heart. Because that's, you know, that's different. It's only lust if it's done with your soul. But it's just what the body naturally does if it's just physical.
And I would say Gnosticism really hasn't ever left us either.
You know, no, it's...
I mean, it's a lot of the New Age thought.
Yep.
You know, in fact, I was just watching a documentary, really fascinating, called The Century of the Self. You can watch it on YouTube. It was a great documentary made about 25 years ago. But it's about Freud and the psychology, the innovative psychology and its effect on the 20th century, and how that eventually gets us to this radical understanding of the self, and how like Maslow and self-realization and understanding the self becomes like the greatest... most important thing, you know, and Herbert Marcuse plays a big role in that, which gives rise to like 60s radicalism. Anyway, it's quite interesting. So, but in many respects, it's like the idea comes to be, well, what am I? Who am I? Like there's some secret in my brain, you know, that is my true self. And I think Christianity has kind of moderated a lot of that because we are bodies and souls.
Right.
Right? We agree with that?
Oh, I agree with that.
Okay, okay,
yeah.
As I was saying that, I was like, wait, what is his position on the soul again? So since I hosted a debate where you talked about this, I should know. But anyway, but yeah, we are bodies and souls, and so we don't denigrate one or the other, just as we don't denigrate the incarnation of Christ. So getting right back to the Second Council.
Okay. Yeah. So the Second Council wrapped everything up with saying that the humanity of Jesus is consubstantial with his divinity. So it's the same one person that is both man and divine, but they end it there because everybody's happy. And really, there's just a lot more to keep going down. So there end up being at least four more councils to deal with even more issues that are coming. Everybody's happy. We enter into a kind of golden age historically in Christianity. So the Western Roman Empire is not doing so hot at this stage. They've got all sorts of northern invaders that are coming through. But Christianity, as far as doctrines are concerned, is spreading like wildfire in Egypt, Ethiopia, Arabia, and Persia, in addition to the Roman Empire. So we have like a nice growth period after Council Number 2. But as it spreads, it kind of just invites the idea of division, which is ultimately what's going to happen here in Council 3 and 4.
Yeah.
So in Council, because of this, the declaration of Jesus being both human and divine simultaneously, the question is going to be how. And the idea that the physical world is bad and needs to be separate from the divine was held by the Bishop of Constantinople. So it's literally the top bishop. He's directly working with the emperor, and he's in the one that gets accused of heresy. The story for this is super cool, though. It's a layperson in his congregation that yells and screams at him during one of his sermons.
Wow!
And that's the fire that embroils the empire once again. So
lay people, you've got the power.
Stand up and yell at your pastors. Yeah. So the Nestorius is preaching a sermon about how about Mary. As Protestant as we want to be, we should not be saying that Mary is unimportant.
Right.
He's preaching a sermon about Mary, and he's saying that we should not call Mary Theotokos, because that means Mother of God, and God is not born of anyone. God is eternal, and instead we should call her Christotokos. And the parishioner that gets up and starts yelling at Nestorius, like a counter sermon over the top of him, yells, "God the Son decided to be born a second time," and that was his counter argument. The emperor is literally there in the crowd. So like this immediately becomes a huge thing. And after a couple of years, they end up calling another council on this. The Council of Ephesus, again, this is a suburb of Nicaea, just a suburb of Constantinople. Ephesus had the second most number of bishops at. I'm forgetting the number, but it's like upper 300s that were called from everywhere. And this includes areas that were not well under control from the empire. So Syria was not horribly under control because they were always at war with the Sassanids, which is Persia, which is Iran. But it included actually Sassanid bishops as well. So it had the whole topic starts with Mary. And then when they list out 12 demands that you must believe as a good, faithful Christian. So this one, they get a little more specific. It's no longer 3.5. It's very, very stern 12 things. And the first one is about Mary, and the other 11 are about Jesus.
Yeah.
Because what we say about Mary actually impacts what we say about Jesus.
Let's stop there, though, because this Theotokos thing is still around. Because one of the things our Roman Catholic friends will say is, how can you not pray to Mary? Borderline worship Mary. She's the mother of God. Well, that isn't a statement about Mary. It's more, I mean, it is, but it's a statement about who's in the womb. You know, so if she's the mother of God, the point is that that Jesus is God, that the man, the baby is God. So he doesn't become God, say, at the baptism or something like that, like you were mentioning. He doesn't evolve into God. He isn't turned into God by the New Testament authors. Even before the incarnation, the Son is always, by the way, the Son doesn't come into being at the incarnation. Father, Son, and Spirit exist at all times, immaterially, timelessly, we would argue. I mean, this is, I think, Orthodox theology. But only the Son becomes incarnate at a point in time. Obviously, the story of Christmas, right? So Mary is the mother of God, meaning that she is, that God was in her womb.
Right.
From the very moment of incarnation.
So the implications are what they are looking for.
Yes.
That he did not become God at a later point, that he was God before he entered her womb. That those are things they really wanted to emphasize.
Yeah.
And that was ultimately Nestorius's error.
Yeah.
So there might be some historical debacle if we got a couple of nerds watching this podcast. It is currently contended that Nestorius might have not have been as strong on this position as he was made out to be by his opponents.
So Nestorius is the Bishop of Constantinople.
He's the Bishop of Constantinople,
And there are still Nestorians. Well, not still, but there was a Nestorian school.
No, there are still Nestorians today.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So this council ultimately creates a split. So you have the Church of the East that leaves.
Oh, okay.
So the Church of the East ends up being Nestorian, and in particular had a lot of power in Syria and Persia.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So that...
But the Eastern Orthodox today would not be considered Nestorian.
Correct. No. So the Church of the East and Eastern Orthodox are different... Different chunks here. Yeah.
Okay.
So they're occasionally called the Assyrian Church of the East, and specifying like the exact area that they had a power base at the beginning. And geographically, they might have been one of the largest churches that existed for a time. They had really great evangelism efforts to the Mongols. Hmm. And so like the Mongolians conquered a lot. And so they –
Genghis Khan
was a Nestorian.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, they didn't hold to anywhere close to what we would call like Orthodox Christianity today.
Yeah, yeah.
He was very likely also Buddhist at the same time.
Okay.
And part of the reason that I'm going to keep calling it Nestorian, regardless of whether Nestorius actually held to this strongly of the doctrine, Nestorianism is compatible with other religions because you can fit other things in there. That's also kind of part of the problem.
Because you have a lower view of – because Christ doesn't become male?
Because
Christ isn't God.
Because in particular, the unity of human and divine is very weak.
Okay.
And so in the actual Nestorian heresy – There is not one person, but there's two.
The Council of Ephesus is which one of these? Third or fourth?
Third.
So it's the third.
Yeah,
okay.
431 is the year.
And by the way, to this day, there are those who argue, well, I affirm the first seven councils, and then there's a break. People say, well, I affirm the first, I think, four councils, and then there's a break or something like that. So we'll come back to that. But okay. So the main issue then is now this issue, like, okay, Theotokos, mother of God. So when does God and man merge? Or I don't know. I'm probably not putting that well. So
no, yeah, it has to do with how strong is the unity between the human and the divine.
Okay,
and Nestorianism in particular is a weak unity.
Why didn't Homo Ousius solve that?
So they still wanted to say that the divine logos was consubstantial with the Father, was Homo Ousius with the Father, but maybe the human Jesus was not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's the issue.
So
there
you've
we go.
Got Father, Son, and Spirit. They're like, Father, Son, and Spirit. They're all three God. No problem. Three persons, one being.
Right.
But the human aspect of Jesus is not. In fact, God, this came up at the debate.
I keep
thinking.
I was there live and I couldn't comment.
Yeah. I was like, okay. So because in the cross-examination, Dale Tuggy kept talking about, the human Jesus. Okay, let's put some meat on the bones real fast. Like one of the questions was, did Yahweh die on the cross? And the answer is, well, the human nature of I don't want to misquote Dr. White here, but essentially yes, the human being that we call Jesus died, but Yahweh did not die.
So. I think White would refuse to go into the philosophies of divine and human natures and all those kinds of things. He's going to pull from Scripture alone.
Yeah.
And he's going to assume that any other argument is lesser. So Yeah, I wish that he would have, though, because using the language of the councils might have helped the part of his cross-examination.
Gotcha.
It would have been way more specific. Because it's very clear that the person died, but in Nestorianism, there's two persons. There's the divine logos that is consubstantial with the Father, okay. And then there's a human Jesus, and somehow they're linked together in a mysterious way.
Okay, so we would – okay, so now we get into one person, two natures. Or maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong. But this is where if I take a Trinity test on like online, like these websites, it's like, what kind of heretic are you? Like, I'm going to get tripped up on this. I'm just saying. Okay. So I understand. I got the one being three persons. I got that down. But now when you start talking about natures,
yeah.
So explain this to me.
So honestly, the general culture, as I said, has been the Trinity is complicated. Don't worry about it. I promise you Christology is worse.
Okay.
So there is...
It's like a sub-aspect of the Trinity.
Yeah. So by divine nature, what the first two councils meant was the Trinity, that there's one nature that nature has three persons.
So when we say being in nature, almost like synonymous.
Yeah. In this case, yeah. They're going to be. So you will get things like you and I both have a human nature, but we're not the same being.
Yeah.
So nature is we could probably translate that into essence and be super consistent the whole way through. So that there's one divine essence. There's not three divine essences. There's one divine nature. There's not three divine natures.
Okay. So how many natures does Jesus have?
Jesus has two.
Okay.
Yeah. So
is that
and
using,
that's the awkwardness.
Is that using the word nature in the same way?
Correct.
Okay. So God has one nature, but Jesus has two natures.
Correct.
Okay. Explain
that. So what the best way to explain is John 1. So John 1 through 14 talks about their eternal logos that was with God and is God. And then ultimately the word, the logos, becomes flesh. So the second person of the Trinity, as was yelled out by that lay member of the church in Constantinople, chose to be born of Mary. But it's the same person. So what Council of Ephesus ruled was that it is a hypostatic union, which means personal. Hypostatic is personal. So there's a personal
another
union.
10-cent seminary word.
Right. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Except this is in the 201 class.
Yeah, it's 201. Yeah.
The hypostatic union combines the two natures. So that way there is only one person. So
So we have to say there's two natures because – there's a division between man and God.
Right? Yeah, well, because man is not God. Like we are different.
We are
things.
Creatures. He's creator.
Right. So
Jesus is clearly a creature because he eats and sleeps and tires and has
a
emotions.
Has a full human nature in every way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then is born and conceived just like the rest of us were.
But we would say that's necessary for salvation because God has to die on the cross.
Right. Okay. So
did Nestorians deny two natures?
Nestorians are very happy with two natures.
Okay.
But they're not happy with hypostatic union. They're not happy.
Two persons.
Right. Really not happy with God being born of Mary.
And does this have a modern day reflection? I can hear Sarah yelling at her phone right now. Why aren't you talking about Richard Rohr? Anyway, because people talk about like the divine Christ and like mystical Christ or like
I watched that podcast recently.
Okay,
Theology on Air about divine Christ and all the Richard Rohr stuff.
Yeah, do people today pull apart and create Christ as two persons?
Absolutely, and it's basically the case in every cult you can imagine.
Okay,
that. There's a prophet of some sort that then gets unified with God and has a special link. And it's basically the same thing that the Nestorians were claiming.
Yeah.
That was just Jesus and he happened to, as the special link, be able to satisfy God's wrath in some weird
way. Gotcha. Okay.
So it repeats itself on a regular basis.
Okay.
This weak unity, would also be like maybe how some people would explain prophets. That this guy gets to have the word of God spoken to him and then delivers that out to the rest of us. So there's a direct connection of God that this guy has. The rest of us don't have a direct connection. It's indirect connection.
Gotcha. So, yeah. Okay. Okay. So I don't know. We started talking about ideas rather than the actual councils, but I don't know if we jumped into future councils. But so Ephesus is kind of resolved. By the way, we should say too, at some point, you know, when we're talking about, when you're talking about a council, you're talking about, you know, sending out the word, hey, show up, we're going to have a council next year.
Right.
And, you know, it's, there's a lot of logistics involved and not everyone can show up. And depending on the population of who shows up, that can affect certain councils, which is why certain councils are considered like not, not legitimate, right?
Correct.
And so in East and West, okay, now at some point too, let's take another step back. At this time, it is, I think, widely agreed upon that there are sort of five seats of the church at this time, right? You've got Constantinople, you've got Rome, you've got, I think, Antioch.
Correct.
What am I forgetting? Athens?
No, no? It's Alexandria.
Alexandria.
And I'm blanking on the fifth one, too.
Okay. But you have these kind of five
seats. They'll show them on the map that we'll put up
in a minute. Okay, perfect. Yeah. So Rome is the only one in what we would call today the West.
The West.
The other four are in the East. And in the West, they speak Latin. And in the East, they speak Greek. This becomes part of the contention. We're not going to get into it. But things like homoousios, that's a Greek word. And so there are certain ideas that, you know, are argued about, and language does play a role, but culturally they're different. So it kind of does end up setting the stage for the split. And I think icons would have a role in that as well, because you have the iconoclastic controversies
right. that deal with. And that's Council 7. So that's the very end here.
All right. So forwarding in that. But anyway, so you have – that just kind of set the stage for these future splits that really have never been resolved.
Right.
So
the Mary is declared Theotokos for Christological reasons. That it entirely has to do with Mary. They are with Jesus. They don't address Mary in any other way. It's only because of the implications it has about Jesus. And then they declare a strong union between the human nature and divine nature. There's one person that is the Logos, that is Jesus. That's it. What unifies them is the person.
Yeah.
And it's that same second person of the Trinity.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, let's do this. Let's put a pin in it there. We've covered pretty much 1 to 4. We're going to try to get through 7.
We haven't covered 4 yet.
Oh, okay.
We're going to cover 1 through 3.
We're going to do 4 to 7 on a future episode, but we've laid a lot of groundwork, so we'll probably go a little bit faster when we do that. Evan, folks can find you at Missio Dei Anglican Church. You come to the Theology by the Pint event, so check them out there. I'm Evan McClanahan, pastor at First Lutheran, flhouston.org. Sarah, sorry she couldn't be here with us, but do go to Theology by the Pint to learn more and learn how you can help us in this ministry. Please do that. Until next time, we encourage you to question freely, think deeply, and disagree as needed.